Thank you for listening to this Podcast One production. Now available on Apple Podcasts, Podcast One, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts.
On this episode of Killer Jeans.
It shouldn't be happening to me. There's no way. There's just no way.
Imagine being en route to the gym, just like any other day. Until
10, 15 police officers, cars. Gunpoint. I'm like, what's going on? I'm freaking out.
Stepping into a nightmare you can't escape.
He says, whether you plead guilty or not, you're going to end up about 10 years and your life is going to change drastically. It was like this guy was looking into my future and giving me some kind of crazy prophetic word. And I'm like, no, it's not going to happen.
And years later, the ultimate betrayal.
It was unbelievably heartbreaking. And I know it was for him.
The following episode of Killer Jeans contains graphic and sensitive information and material. Listener discretion is advised.
Emmy-nominated true crime journalists bring you cases like you've never heard them before. Hear firsthand accounts from the victims' families, private investigators, lawyers, law enforcement, and even the convicted. Giving you a complete 360 of the case like no one else can.
I'm Melissa McCarty.
I'm Kelly McClear.
And this is Killer Jeans.
In 1989, Adam Riojas from California was living a dream. He was in his late 20s, a newly licensed real estate agent in Hawaii, with paradise as his daily backdrop. One morning, on a routine drive through the picturesque island town headed to the gym, Adam's life changed forever.
I'm with a girl that I was dating at the time. She is like screaming, losing it. We get put on the ground. She's kicking all over the place. They take us in separate vehicles. They cuffed her. They didn't cuff me because she was really like hysterical.
Before heading into the police station in Hawaii, the officer told Adam to get in the front seat. His handcuffs were off. What followed was a haunting conversation.
It's funny because I don't think too many people have asked me this question. And we start talking and he says, you know, I believe you, because he tells me I'm being charged with murder. I tell him I know nothing about some of the details that he's giving me. He says, you know, he says, I know how the system works. And it's an insane conversation because it made no sense to me. The guy says, you'll probably end up doing about 10 years for this. He says, whether you plead guilty or not, you're going to end up about 10 years and your life is going to change drastically. It was like this guy was looking into my future and giving me some kind of crazy prophetic word. And I'm like, no, it's not going to happen. I said, I didn't do this. I have no idea what you're talking about. But he's being very cordial, just an amazing police officer. Right. Get to the jail in Hawaii, and they put me in a single cell, and probably for the next 2 or 3 days, I'm questioned by them, by the Los Angeles Police Department, where this crime happened, and it was like being in a movie, because it was like in a dark room with lights underneath and you're getting questioned and pounded.
Adam was being questioned for a murder that happened weeks prior in Los Angeles during a time he was home visiting his family.
They come into my cell and they say, you're free. I'm like, what? What the heck? And I hear some of the police officers, oh, you have a big lawsuit coming. Oh, they did you wrong. The police officers are saying this, and I am released with no charges pending.
The Ellie murder that the police were questioning him about happened on a special, but now unforgettable day for Adam, December 8th.
It's left this indelible memory because it was on December 8th of 1989 on my birthday, the day in question of this murder. And I was there with a female, a girl that I was dating at the time from Hawaii in San Diego, a city called Carlsbad.
The morning of his birthday, surrounded by family and his girlfriend, there's a knock at the door.
I answered the door, and someone that I had met, who I had gone out with to bars a couple of times, was not a close friend of mine, came up that morning and said if he came with another person. And they asked me if I could give him a ride to go pick up a car. I told him, no, it's my birthday. I'm not going out. I'm here with my girlfriend at the time, and I am not, I'm sorry. And they're like, well, can we borrow your automobile? I'm like, what time do you plan on coming back? It'll only be several hours. We'll be back soon.
Adam carries on celebrating his birthday with family. As promised, his car was returned in the late afternoon hours. He and his girlfriend went to a club in downtown San Diego that night, had a great time, and 2 days later, they flew back to Hawaii. What he didn't realize is the LAPD was gathering evidence in a murder case that seemingly pointed to him as the gunman, starting with his vehicle, a distinctive van. During that moment, were you thinking to yourself, I barely know you. It's kind of ballsy for you to want to loan my car. I mean, what was going through your mind?
I've always been a nice guy. I've always, you know, tried to do everything I can to help people. And it seemed like a rational explanation. The car broke down. We'll be back. Okay, here's the keys.
And it was that generosity that would later cost him his freedom. 9 months after he was first questioned by police in Hawaii, he was arrested for the murder of Jose Rodarte. Had you ever heard the name Jose Rodarte before?
I hadn't heard the name Jose Rodarte, but they showed me a picture of who this guy was. And they asked me if I had ever seen him before. And I thought, and I told them, I said, I said, I see my father several years ago.
Adam was never close to his father. His father wasn't around when he was growing up.
My dad, he was just never really around. I know he was always intoxicated, always had what looked like bad people around him. When I say looked like bad people, language is vulgar. Whenever he would come over, he would always be with somebody, another male or several males. I know, again, when I was 9, we visited him at a federal prison. And I, from what I remember and from what I've been, the records that I've read, he was a smuggler.
Adam took on the father role in the family for his two brothers and sister.
I don't think I really ever had these sibling relationships. I was more authoritative, making sure they weren't getting in trouble, making sure they'd help around the house.
Even though Adam was surrounded by his family the day of the murder, he became suspect number one in the case because several eyewitnesses say his van was at the scene of the crime.
I believe the police simply thought that the connection that Adam had to the car meant that he must have been the one responsible.
Attorney Alex Simpson with the California Innocence Project says alibis don't carry much weight in court. Was Adam's timeline that day accounted for? Did his fiance at that point in life go on the record and say, I was with him all day?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, everybody said, consistent with what Adam was saying, that he was, you know, spending time with family. It was his birthday. It was, you know, that was the reason why it was significant to him and to other people in his family. You know, I think the problem with alibi evidence that you see often in cases is that the alibi that you or I or anybody else has is almost always family members, friends, people that you're spending the most time with. And in a criminal prosecution, that type of evidence, you know, somebody, your mother coming forward to say he was with me, or your fiance coming forward to say, you know, he was with me, is looked on with great suspicion, even though it's something that happens every day to every single one of us.
At the crime scene and around Adam's neighborhood, officers with the LAPD showed eyewitnesses a photo lineup.
They showed everybody six packs of everybody who witnessed this crime, and nobody picked me out of lineups. What's really interesting is once I was arrested, I was brought back. I hired my own attorney at the time because I still had money. I sold real estate. And the attorney told me, hey, they want to do lineups. Once they do the lineups, if nobody that witnessed the crime picks you, they'll let you go. And of course, I did the lineups. Nobody picked me out of lineups that witnessed the crime. And they didn't let me go.
Eyewitnesses are generally, especially stranger eyewitnesses, are very, it's very difficult for them to correctly recall the information of the person who committed a crime. And it's very easy, if you're not careful, to influence them, not even intentionally influence them, but unintentionally influence them to select an individual from a lineup or from a photo array.
Dowdy eyewitnesses and an officer who was showing Adam's photo to people.
They also tend to believe, even if the officer doesn't say anything, that, well, this officer seems pretty confident that this person is the perpetrator. So I believe that this person is the perpetrator. So by the time of trial, the identification becomes 100%. Even if previously, even if the first time they weren't at all confident in their identification. And that's what happened in Adam's case. I think the prosecution's theory at the time was that the case was fairly solid because it was based on the testimony of eyewitnesses. Eyewitness identification and eyewitness misidentification is one of the leading factors, if not the leading factor, in wrongful conviction.
Where is that stance legally? Can an officer pull out an image? Does it have to be accompanied by others in a certain environment? How does that work?
So the number one thing is that the entire procedure should be recorded, either audio or video. And that's to make sure that the officer is not giving any clues, indications, hints to the witness, subconsciously or otherwise. The officer should also not have the photo stand out unnecessarily from all of the other photos in the array.
And you're saying those guidelines were not followed with his case?
Some of the safeguards that we now have in place were not even known to be necessary at the time of the identification procedures in Adam's trial.
During the murder trial, Adam wanted to testify, but his attorney wouldn't let him. He was found guilty for the murder of Jose Rodarte, a man he'd never known. When they gave you the verdict in the sentencing, where are you at that point? You told me that, obviously, anger came from many, many months. How did you accept that new reality when the entire thing was just one string of bad events after the next?
Which, you know, a really interesting thing that happened to me is that I had never, ever believed in God, ever. And I know a lot of people still don't, and I know it's not interesting to a lot of people, but I found myself in my darkest moments in my entire life. And you know, I called on God, and I remember this verdict coming down, and I'm in my, they take you to a single cell after that to make sure they watch you for a little bit, make sure you don't, I guess, kill yourself or whatever they expect you to do. And I'm like, man, everything that I had believed recently now, with this newfound belief in God, was all in question. Like, how can this have happened? Why would you allow this to happen? And I had read something really strange in the Bible that said to thank him for everything. And I'm like, what the heck? Thank you for this? Never. Never. And so I probably literally lost my mind for about 24 hours. I didn't know what to think, who to turn to. My whole life had just been changed dramatically. And I didn't know what to do. It wasn't until the next morning when I woke up and said, well, this is my reality. And I just have to make the best of it. And I didn't thank God for being in jail. That would have been stupid. I thanked him that I was feeling better. I didn't go crazy. I didn't go nuts. And that I still had my sanity. And I made a commitment to myself and even to God that I would fight.
You know, I cannot begin to imagine what he was going through at that time. To say that he accepts this as his new reality is really profound and scary at the same time. I mean, how many of us could say what our reaction would be if we're put in a similar situation? Would we kill ourselves? Would we accept this as our new reality? Or would we fight? Well, Adam fought. And he wrote every single major organization and agency he could. And 10 long years later, another inmate told him about the Innocence Project. 8 months went by, and he finally got the call.
Adam's case was one of the cases that jumped out at us almost immediately as a case of wrongful conviction. You know, we have thousands of cases and people who ask for our assistance every year. Of those thousands of cases, we reject almost all of them.
For Adam, it was his first real sign of hope. Adam, did you feel like your prayers were answered?
Of course. Yeah, definitely. I was like, this has got to be the greatest thing you've ever done, God. I was in prison. There's crazy rules in there where you can't eat, can't hang out with a different color. And because of my newfound faith, I did all of that. And my life was threatened a million times in there, but I refused to bow down to any prejudice, any of that racial stuff. I was a jock in school, so I played with, the majority of my team was in football, was blacks and Samoans. And you know, when I ran track and played soccer, so I wasn't going to bow down to that. And eventually they left me alone. You know, every time I would move from prison to prison, everybody, my reputation of believing in God, and, you know, Jesus followed me, which is pretty amazing.
But Adam's faith would be put to the ultimate test. There was a break in the case, one that would send shockwaves through his heart. One day, nearly 10 years later, Adam had a call during abnormal hours, which usually equates to bad news.
My aunt is married to my dad's brother. And so I get on the phone, she starts telling me that my dad was in a gets out of his coma, and he starts ranting, and I should be in prison, not my son, and that he's going, he's just saying all these stuff. And there was a nurse in there as well.
Adam's father, in and out of his coma, died the next day. Adam was left confused over his dad's deathbed rant. In fact, it was more than a rant. It was a confession. So your father confesses to the murder and that he should be the one in prison, not you.
Yes, that's correct.
Wow. I can't even begin to imagine what that felt like. I mean, you know, I could just see a complete, I mean, I'm having a complete mix of emotions right now. I mean, I'm tearing up listening to you telling the story, but then I'm also super angry at your father, you know, for holding this in for so many years. Did you experience similar roller coasters of emotions?
Well, here's what's really kind of, I don't know. I have mixed feelings, ambivalent feelings towards this whole thing, because I wasn't angry at that point. I was, like I said, I just said, man, I'm going to get to go home soon. And I didn't really think about it. I was more, and it almost sounds cool because I didn't really think about him. Nothing mattered. I didn't hold anything against him at that point. I was just thinking, man, I'm glad this coward said something.
Adam's father confessed to several people at various times over the years, friends and associates. In his last moments of life, he finally felt remorse.
And I think those are the most powerful, because that was the time that Adam's father was really trying to square all of the terrible things that he did in his life and to try to seek absolution.
Attorney Alex Simpson will never forget the moment he had to explain the details of everything that took place to Adam during a jailhouse visit.
And when we explained to him that we had uncovered the evidence that showed his father had confessed to committing this crime, it was unbelievably heartbreaking. And I know it was for him. You could see the complex emotions straight on his face. And to his credit, he is an incredibly forgiving person. And I think he is trying to take this whole process and figure out how he can use it to make himself better. But I don't think any of us could ever understand what it would be like to find out that your father not only committed this crime, but allowed you to go to prison for it. It's just unfathomable.
What was his father's motive? Why did he kill Jose Rodarte?
These individuals grabbed the van, and then they also picked up Adam's father, because Adam's father and the victim had a falling out, had a business relationship, and had a falling out.
The why is sketchy, but it boils down to money, a debt that was owed. As for evidence missed, police knew the person who borrowed his van went to meet up with Adam's father.
So the fascinating thing about, and the tragic thing about Adam's case, is that Adam and his father look astonishingly similar, or they did at the time. So I don't think the witnesses were necessarily completely off base when they were making their identification. They look very, very alike.
Even so, police had evidence pointing toward Adam's father, but never investigated it further.
Police all knew a couple of different things. Number one, that Adam's father was a very bad guy and related to other criminal activity. They knew that these individuals were associates of him. And they knew that these individuals had at the very least said that they were looking for Adam's father on the day of the shooting.
His father was never even brought in for questioning.
the interesting thing about all of those puzzle pieces is that they never put it together that Adam's father, instead of Adam, may have been one of the perpetrators in the crime. You know, these individuals were obviously associates. They were in the drug trade. Adam's father was in the drug trade. You know, they were supposed to be hanging out together, and they were looking for Adam's father. And ultimately, the victim in the case is had a fractured relationship with Adam's father and owed him money. And so all of those things could have been discovered by police instead of what actually happened.
And was that ever revealed why, if they knew he had a rap sheet, if they knew he had this past, why they never even questioned him?
I can't tell you why investigators decided not to continue to pursue an investigation into Adam's father. I think sometimes, and this is human nature, if you believe that a particular conclusion is correct, then you tend to work backwards to try to get your evidence to fit that conclusion rather than looking at the evidence and seeing where that evidence points to.
Beyond the unreliable eyewitnesses, there was one other piece of evidence linking Adam's father to the murder.
The detectives and the investigators investigating the case found a piece of paper in the victim's wallet, and that piece of paper had Adam's father's name on it and his phone number. And the detectives, rather than believing or making the connection that Adam's father may have been the perpetrator because of that piece of evidence, they used that to show that there was a connection between the victim and Adam.
Now, with the Innocence Project deep in the fight to get Adam Riojas released, they had two independent investigations re-interviewing witnesses, plus a deathbed confession. And the guy who borrowed Adam's van for the crime was arrested but never fessed up about the real trigger man. Another cowardly move blocking Adam's freedom. The fastest way to release Adam was not an exoneration, but a parole plea, as he was eligible since he'd already spent 13 years in prison. At this hearing, it was a profound moment.
The district attorney has the right to attend those parole hearings and argue for or against the person's parole. And Adam's case is the only case in my almost 15 years of being an attorney where the district attorney, on the record in the parole hearing, said that they did not believe Adam committed the crime.
Adam was finally released through the parole process instead of being fully exonerated. So he was not qualified for compensation. But in this moment, it didn't matter to Adam. He was finally free.
I mean, I got mixed emotions. All kinds of stuff is going through my mind. I remember stopping at a gas station, and it's like, and they gave me like $200 when I left prison. And I remember going in there and buying a soda, and it was like the strangest feeling. I bought a soda and I bought a candy bar. And it's like, wow, like walking on air, literally walking on air. And a million things going on through my mind. I hope I make it home. I hope he doesn't crash. I want to see my family. I'm glad that this happened. Why did it take so long? It's just, my mind is just all over the place. But I can tell you that it was a great moment. You know, and when I think back now, it was one of the best moments of my life.
The Innocence Project lawyers have been fighting with the state to change Adam's release status to full exoneration.
I'm very confident that Adam will be able to get both fully exonerated and have his conviction reversed, and that he will be able to get compensation because of that.
And when it comes to forgiveness, How did you do that? And it's a very difficult, tricky thing. How did you continue to stay present and just appreciate every second of your freedom and release all the anger? Or was it just the act of living itself that helped?
I actually went home that night, and I've said this several times, and I know what happened. I literally got into a wrestling match with God. my profound belief now, and it literally wrestled. I just had to move on with life, and I had to forgive this man, and I did, and I only have a hard time with this when I have to speak about it.
Adam didn't waste away while in prison. He earned 12 vocations, from masonry, computer programming, to becoming a pastor. His life now? Married with 2 beautiful daughters.
I love them to death. They are the sweetest little angels on the entire planet Earth. And I just love them to death.
The California Innocence Project has worked to pass new guidelines for eyewitness testimony and procedures for officers in the field when crimes occur, all of which go into effect in 2021 to better serve people like Adam Riojas.
The thing that's unique about Adam's case is Adam. He's been able to take this tragedy, a family tragedy, a personal tragedy, and turn it into something positive. I mean, he's a pastor now. He is trying to make the world better. And I think that's a real testament to him, because I know that if I had gone through an experience like that, I don't know that I would have had that kind of strength.
Adam has a court date coming up, a hearing to fully exonerate and qualify for wrongful conviction compensation after serving 13 years. At 59 years old, compensation won't repair what was taken.
I don't think money could ever buy freedom. No. Money can't. I don't think if you gave me $1 trillion, it wouldn't pay for the years that I lost.
But it will certainly help with his new life. And it's all thanks to the Innocence Project, who fights for people like Adam. And that's why he recounts the pain to us. For people to know what can be stolen and what agencies like the CIP can do to help. If you'd like to support their cause, please check out their website.
If you're asking me what I think of freedom now, this is what it looks like to me. I see a big blue sky. I see an ocean. I see trees, and they're greener to me than they've ever been, even in dry seasons. I don't complain. I don't hang out with people that are whiny or complain. I look at every day as a gift from God. I can breathe. I'm alive. I'm healthy. My life began the day I walked out of prison. Really began. I see everything with different eyes. I don't see ugly. I see the good of people. Even when people act ugly, I see the good. I see the good of people, because it's who I am now.